This is John Ryan Howell, Romantic Love, From Foolishness to Transformation, September 12th, 2014. And this was recorded on DVD, and it has quite a few images. The DVD is in the library at the Seattle Young Society.
So I'm Jim Gossett, and I'm a member of the Young Society, and really privileged to be able to introduce John Huell tonight. And we are blessed to have him. John is a long-term analyst in the Boston area, 34 years, training in religious studies at Temple University in Philadelphia. And it's a special treat for me. I know the topic tonight is, well, I think it's about divine madness, and I can't imagine a better kind of madness. But in a way, going to Zurich is a kind of divine madness, too, to do training. And for once, it's a really sweet joy to experience Zurich coming to me, because John is one of our instructors there, and for the last five semesters, he's been leading a brilliant tour of the collected works. Not an easy subject, but undoubtedly valuable to all the people who are training in Zurich. So I am honored to be able to be the person to introduce you to John, and please welcome John Huell.
Thank you very much. So our topic tonight is From Foolishness to Transformation. And the much of the material is drawn from, in fact, the spirit of the night is drawn from this book that I wrote, had published in 1990. Divine Madness, Archetypes of Romantic Love. And the reason I wrote the book is that it seemed to me that love, romantic love, usually got treated rather poorly in our world, in our culture. Basically, it's a kind of madness, a kind of foolishness, but a lucky one. Because, you know, it gets you involved with somebody, makes babies, and establishes a nice unit of society. So you go through this madness to take on something that turns out to require a great deal of commitment and responsibility, and so it does a great service to society. But forget about the romantic part. That was just to get you interested. And my thought about the whole thing was, and then my experience about the whole thing is, that there's a lot more to it than that. And I would like to talk about some of those things today. I would say, though, love really does make us mad, but if we handle it well, it brings us the transformation we're looking for. I'd like to begin with a couple of references to Swami Muktananda's book, Play of Consciousness. On the one side of the screen, you can see Swami's picture as it appears on my copy of Play of Consciousness, somewhat battered, as you see. And down in the other corner is a picture I like better, because he looks a little sly in this picture. And he's leading us on a kind of sinuous journey into the nature of meditation in this passage. He says that one time a young man came to him and said, "Guru, help me. I've fallen in love, but the girl has married someone else." And Muktananda says, "Well, that's an easy problem. Just find another girl and marry her." Whereupon the young man says, "But I can't stop thinking about her. She intrudes into my thoughts day and night." And Muktananda says, "I have the same problem. I meditate on my Satguru, Nityananda, day and night. I can't get him out of my mind." So he's being playful with us here, but there's something really very serious about this. I mean, one of the things that's going on in this story is he's telling us that we're all meditating a lot more than we know we are. And he makes the point even more strongly when he says, "And yes, there was also a factory owner who came to me one day and said, 'Guru, help me with my meditation. It's not going well.'" And I said to him, well, what happens when you meditate? And he says, as soon as I sit down, I start thinking about my factory and my family. And so I said to him, Muktananda says, well, isn't that what you want to think about? Aren't these the most important things in your life? Is there something you'd rather be meditating on? So again, he brings us back to this idea that we meditate on a lot of things even if we don't wish to. And we feel that there might be something else that would be more worthy of our meditation, that might even help us somewhat. And there is a suggestion here. I'm making a suggestion that maybe the young man knows something when he says, I can't stop thinking about her. She intrudes into my thoughts day and night. Maybe he too has something important to say about this whole question. I think maybe I need to clarify one point, however. That whole idea of a sat guru. Sat is a Sanskrit word that means being, and you usually hear it in the phrase sat chit ananda, meaning being, consciousness, bliss. And those three words, Hindus say, sum up the whole of Hinduism. The being of Sat is cosmic being. It is all the being there is. And for Muktananda, that being is Shiva. The consciousness of Shiva and Shakti, in fact, in eternal intercourse, is the ultimate reality. Their consciousness is the cosmos. It's rather a different view that we have in the West. We think that everything in the cosmos is material. And maybe there are other beings around that are of a different nature altogether, called souls, that make those material machines run about and go to lectures and things like that. The Hindu view really is that consciousness is the ultimate reality. And the being of the universe is the consciousness of Shiva, and we are all the consciousness of Shiva. So when Muktananda says, I have the same problem. I meditate on my Satguru Nityananda day and night. I can't get him out of my mind. What he means is, I'm meditating on the whole cosmos as it's mediated to me through my Satguru Nityananda. And the young man, something must be mediating, that must be being mediated for the young man by that girl too. And we'll have to get around to talking about that. But I also like to point out, it's not only in Hinduism where you hear such talk. In Sufism, for example, now, I didn't prepare a slide on that. And in Sufism, they say that one passes away through one's sheikh, through one's guru. And ultimately what this means is somehow my existence passes away through his. I lose who I thought I was and pour into him, as it were. And the value of that is, I have passed away into my sheikh, who has passed away into Muhammad, and Muhammad has passed away into God. So we are all passing away through a relationship of profound love in which the person of our attention is revealing something to us about the nature of the cosmos and about the potential of our own being. So, my point here is that eros, that emotion that is without which we would not have romantic love, eros opens the door to sat. Something new is going on as soon as one reaches that point where I can't stop thinking about him or her day and night. One has been hooked by something greater than anything one has ever seen before. So, the madness of seeing and living in this greater cosmos of Sat is divine, of Sat is divine madness. It's because everybody around you thinks you're certainly on a weird trip. There's something there's something very strange about thinking that the material world around you is not the ultimate world, that there is something else. So with this madness, when one has this madness, when one is in this madness, every beloved is a sort of satguru, or potentially is a satguru. What holds us back is our reluctance to give up the pseudo-reality of everyday security and prestige. That is to say, what holds us back from entering that cosmos that Muktananda enters day and night through his satguru, Nityananda, what's holding us back is our reluctance to give up the pseudo-reality of everyday security and prestige. And just so you don't think I'm only talking about Asians here, Christian mystics also know about sat. Here is a quotation from a 13th century Franciscan, Jacopone de Todi, who said, "I know well, O highest wisdom, that if I am mad, it is your doing. This dates from the day I surrendered myself to you and was drawn, I know not how, to new life." So the same sort of sentiments from a Christian. And another Sufi, Jalaluddin Rumi, as you probably know, was a fairly standard teacher of Islamic theology and mysticism before the day that he met Shams ad-Din al-Sirraj. And Shams closeted himself with Rumi and taught him an entirely different kind of mysticism based on a sort of mad love of God. Shams eventually disappeared, and it was a great loss for Rumi, but what he discovered after that was anyone can be his satguru, to use the Indian term for a guy from Iran. Rumi would recite his poetry, in a sense sing his poetry. He didn't write it down himself. He always had a scribe writing it down. And his scribe was the person through whom he was passing away while singing his poetry. And here's an example. "He who came in a red frock in years past, he came this year in a brown garb. The Turk about whom you heard that time appeared as an Arab this year. The wine is one, only the bottles are different. How beautifully does this wine intoxicate us." So again, the madness of, in this case, wine suggests that madness is brought on by each one of those scribes. The guy in the red frock, the guy in the brown garb, the Turk, the Arab, they were all ways for Rumi to pass away into the reality of God, the reality of the cosmos. The terms, by the way, in Arabic are rather poetic, even as they sound. The word for pass away is fana, F-A-N-A with a glottal stop at the end of the A. And when you have passed away, then you discover your wholeness. Jungians always pick up on this if they know this doctrine, because you've passed away from ego and passed into self. And several of the Sufis have made that Jungian point themselves. So to pass away, fana, and to discover the self, baka, B-A-Q-A with a glottal stop. So our thesis this evening is, Eros can be the engine of and produce the defining challenges for our individuation journey. So that young man is potentially on a journey, and even the disappearance of the girl that he thought he was going to marry may be a part of it. I mean, you hear that story and you think, what a naive guy that young man is, to think that simply because he thought that she would marry him, that she had to. And now she's gone off faithlessly and married somebody else. She probably found someone better to pass away into, is probably what had happened. And, you know, some people are more easy to pass away through than others. So, step one. Eros introduces us to the archetypes of the collective unconscious. And the collective unconscious opens the door onto the unity of the cosmos. It really is stepping through a kind of door. This is, I think, the reason why, and first of all, it seems to me that the main way that most of us are apt to find ourselves passing through some sort of door into another realm is in the realm of romantic love. But and when you do, if you have, you know that the world is completely different afterward than what it was before. You may not be able to put words around it, but there's something else there, some new potential that you feel you can't lose. That if you do lose somehow, and I've heard this many times from Anna Lizanne's, the feeling that if I can't find a way of bringing this back into life, I'm not going to survive. They probably would survive physically, but they wouldn't survive psychologically. They wouldn't survive in the way they know they could live if they can't find a way to get in touch with that again. So that really, I would say, is the reason that the young man is so distressed and can't stop thinking about the girl, and he wants a solution which will tell him, how do I get there? How do I get back the peace I lost when she married somebody else? And Muktananda gave him a very vague-seeming answer to the young man, I suppose, when he said, why, that's just like me. You know, my Satguru Nityananda. I meditate on him day and night. He saw that there was something similar between these two things. Going on with the archetypes, Jung's favorite example to illustrate what an archetype is, and I gave some references from the collected works down in the bottom of the screen in small type, the yucca moth sees, smells, and feels the blossoming of the yucca plant, and I've got pictures of both the plant and the moth up there, is an archetypal image that triggers that archetypal image, in this case the blooming plant, triggers the instinctual pattern of reproducing itself in the yucca moth. Jung points out it's a fairly complicated procedure. I don't remember all the details, but I know that it has something to do with wrapping its eggs in pollen and stuffing them into another portion of the flower. So it's a fairly complicated thing, and the reason that Jung points this out is the yucca moth lives a very, very short time as an adult. It does only one thing as an adult. It mates and leaves its seeds, its eggs, to grow into the caterpillars next year. It has spent a good long time as a caterpillar when it only ate. It had no idea of falling in love. It had no idea of perpetuating the species. And then went through that period of time when it all sort of dissolves and the DNA of the caterpillar, having more, some parts turned off and other parts turned on, eventually creates the form of the winged moth, who has only one job, to mate. Now, I suppose, not having been a moth, I suppose that a moth flies around without knowing what its destination can be, without knowing of a destination until the moment it sees and smells that yucca blossom. Suddenly it has purpose. Suddenly something transcendent has taken over in the life of the moth. That's what archetypes do for us. They introduce us to a whole new level of life, when they kick in, we might say. And the moth can do only one thing. One of the reasons Jung presents this example several times in his collected works, and a few other examples too, also using insects like the leaf cutter ant, he uses it because these creatures don't have much freedom. They do the same actions every time. Every individual in the species does the same things in the same way. For us, it's different. When an archetype grabs us, we can react in a whole bunch of ways. In fact, probably 3/4 of the Greek myths are about different ways of falling in love, different ways of fighting with your lover, different ways of losing a lover, or finding another one, or being betrayed. All of these things that fit into that realm of the reproductive archetype, for us humans, very varied. All sorts of scenarios involved. So the blooming yucca plant is for the moth, pictures such as these, mythological pictures that have been painted by great artists or great artisans, bringing together elements of what that undertaking, the undertaking that the archetype drives, pictured there. So we could say what the yucca plant was to Muktananda's young man, images like this are for members of the West or members of the East, cultures of the West or East. And those almost looked, I suppose you could say, you could tell that they were meant to be mythic pictures and hardly pornographic pictures. But, you know, we in the West especially have the idea that looking at pictures of naked women, particularly, are something no respectable person would do. And for that reason, I find that this passage from Mircea Eliade, the historian of religion, in his book Yoga, Immortality, and Freedom, is extremely interesting and enlightening. This is somewhere halfway through or more the book where he takes up the topic of sexual yoga briefly. And he introduces the topic in part by saying, if in the presence of the naked woman, one does not find in one's inmost being the same terrifying emotion that one feels before the revelation of the cosmic mystery, there's no right. There is only a secular act. So what he's saying is that in that, he's capturing something of what humans feel when they're in that yucca place of finding the blooming flower. You know, and that's the moment of transformation where something, whoa, this is something I never expected before. This is something transformative that's going on here. That's the thing that he's pointing out there. So this is, if we hear about activities undertaken by practitioners of sexual yoga that seem a bit indecent to us, what we must realize, it is indecent if these people are not in the same terrifying emotion that one feels before the revelation of the cosmic mystery. And notice, it's the cosmic mystery again. The same Sat that Shiva reveals to Muktananda through Nityananda. It's the same being, cosmic being, which is all that there is. Somehow, I'm part of that. And of course, the vision, I actually meant to mention this earlier, Muktananda also in the Play of Consciousness gives us a number of his experiences, mystical experiences, and one of the most important, I think, is the one where he tells us he glimpses what Sat means. He's meditating on one particular day in which It's as though his visual field opens up, and he sees that the cosmos itself is constructed of threads of light, and the threads of light are woven into a great tapestry of light. And besides that, everything he sees around him in the world, the trees, the people, the animals, the butterflies, everything is in those threads. So the vision he sees, it's hard to, I didn't write it down to read to you for this, but the point he's trying to get across is this world we see around us is real enough. I have no argument against that. But we see it with our fleshly eyes. When we use our sensory functions to see the world around us, we see one vision, the vision that is the vision that can appear before our senses. What he saw in his mystical state of consciousness was that thing, the sensory world, is a piece of, but overwhelmed by, the cosmos of light. It's a vision, it sounds to me, very much like what we see from the Hubble telescope. That is to say, light of all sorts, thousands and thousands of points of light and streaks of light and entanglements of light that comprise what is. One school of mysticism which presents a view very much like this says, you know you got there when in one moment all you see is the light, and the next moment you are the light. You are the cosmos that you were seeing a moment before. Now it's dark because you're not seeing it, you are it. And then it becomes light, and then it becomes dark. This is called the Spanda school, the school of vibration. And again, the view of the ultimate is the view of the cosmos, and it's the cosmos as this, of which this world here is but a small condensation, you might say, just what we can pick up with our eyes, ears, and so forth. Well, so, in the presence of the naked woman, one finds the terrifying emotion one has before the revelation of the cosmic mystery. We have all sorts of ways of dealing with that, as you no doubt know. I'm going to give you two. I don't recommend either of them as where we need to go in our mystical life, but I think you'll see what I mean, that this is a world in which we need to gain some mastery. Eliade is describing the situation at the beginning of a ritual process that is meant to lead the mystic into a brand new understanding of himself and of the cosmos and of relationship. But for a young man encountering it for the first time, it's rather different. So I found this little passage in an early novel of D.H. Lawrence. Mr. Noon, it's called, and in the passage, the young man, hero of the tale, is skinny dipping for the first time with his girlfriend. And D.H. Lawrence describes the situation this way. Gathering his courage in both hands, he managed to look on the naked woman of his desire without starting to grovel. Which, if you have profound desire, isn't so easy. You either grovel or overween, or else groveling you overween. For to be neither more nor less than just yourself on such an occasion, well, that takes time and a second and a sound heart. Probably don't have to dwell on this very, very awkward movement of where the young man is overwhelmed. He's before that cosmic mystery. But apparently he doesn't know it yet as a cosmic mystery. It's just too much to handle. And here is a man who's apparently spent his life dealing with it in a way that I'm sure many of you will object to. Yet, you'll have to admit, he's achieved something. He's certainly gone way beyond Mr. Noon in his... this comes from a school of sexual yoga called Sahajiya. which is a tantric technique to maintain equanimity in the midst of extreme arousal. And this is a translation from a sacred text from that tradition by this man, E.C. Dimmock. The book is entitled The Place of the Hidden Moon, a classic in mystical literature. Ramananda had two temple girls of surpassing beauty who were skilled in music and the dance. He used to take them both into a lonely garden where they would sing to him. With his hands, he would rub their bodies with oil and bathe their bodies and limbs and clothe and decorate them. But still, the mind of Ramananda remained unaffected. His passion was the same at the touch of a piece of wood or stone as it was at the touch of a young woman. Such was the nature of Ramananda Raya. He played the role of servant to them. Obviously, the man who wrote this thinks that Ramananda Raya has achieved something wonderful. I'm sure everyone in this room does not think he's necessarily gotten to the end of his mystical journey. I would like to know much more about what those young ladies are experiencing in this process. But we learn nothing of that. But we do know that the point I was trying to get across, though, is there are things we can do to help us manage and hold on to this transcendent sense, this possibility of moving into another realm. The founder, by the way, of Sahajiya was an individual by the name of Chaitanya, who claimed that in his experience, he was both Krishna and Radha, the two of the great love stories in Hinduism. And I might point out that Jung had pretty much the same experience. In Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, he tells us that after that embolism he had in his heart, where he nearly died, he was several days hovering at the edge of death. His nurse said that she saw in him the complexion. His skin had the look of a man who was dying. And he said he would drag himself through the days, and then he would wake up in ecstasy every night. And in that ecstasy, he would experience the hieros gamos, the wedding of the gods. Sometimes he would be Hera or Zeus. Sometimes he would be Christ or his church. A whole variety of different weddings of the gods were experienced on those nights. And in sometimes, he said, sometimes he was one of the people being married, and sometimes he was the wedding itself. And when he came back from that experience, he knew that all that he had been writing about alchemy was true, and he needed to publish it. Up to this time, he'd been working on it. He thought he was onto something good, but he was too frightened of rejection and unsure that it wasn't just his own personal interpretation. So, something like this is playing out in that famous dance that probably everyone knows about, where Krishna dances with all the milkmaids of Vrindavana. They wake up out of their sleep at night, leave their beds with their husbands, and go and dance with Shiva. And each one of them believes that she alone is dancing with Shiva, although they all have that sense. So there's some way in which all of them are entering onto that field, the plane of Vrindavan, where these things happen, where one leaves the realm of ordinary life. And here's another representation of a gopi, milkmaid, dancing with Shiva. And you can see there, this one is a little bit... It's small, of course, but there's a childish look about that whole thing. You know, Shiva is so often the boy god. And I mean, Krishna is so often the boy god. And here we see a little bit more of the powerful archetypal drive behind what's going on that plane of Vrindavan. So back to Muktananda's young man, his plight. He didn't choose it. He can't opt out of it. It opened up a world for him that he can't live without. And yet he can't seem to get back there. And I would argue it's Jung's Corinthian column. Now, when I refer to Jung's Corinthian column, I'm referring to the first paragraph of the book we call Symbols of Transformation. And that paragraph remained unchanged when Jung revised Symbols of Transformation. It was first written in 1912, revised in 1950, where he wanted now to bring all of those views that he had at the beginning of his journey into the archetypes up to the level of his new understanding of analytical psychology. He left this in. And the way the Corinthian column comes into the story is this. He says he was talking about Freud's discovery of the Oedipus complex. And he said, this is how monumental it is. It's as though you're walking down a modern city street, living in that ephemeral world we all live in, where we're thinking about what's going to happen in the next moment or what happened yesterday, and not paying attention to anything big. And you turn the corner and you run across a Corinthian column. And suddenly you realize 2,000 and more years ago, people were living here on this street doing more or less the same things we are doing. There's a continuity of human life here. And the same sorts of deep things are happening again and again in every generation and in every century. That was Jung's first, he still didn't have the term archetype. But it was his first attempt at saying there are things in human life that are always the same, even though they maybe live somewhat differently from one moment to the next. And when you see those things, you know you're onto something structural. So what would Jung say to the young man? I think we all know pretty well what that would be. I think Jung would say, that girl has introduced you to your anima. She's not coming back. Your job is to withdraw the projection. That girl has walked off and married another guy and taken the poor guy's anima with her. And that's what he's looking for. He's looking for the anima, which is the connecting link for a man, as the animus is a connecting link for the woman, to that cosmic realm that lies beyond, to that world of Corinthian columns, to that world of the threads and the cloth that Muktananda talked about when he saw his mystical vision of the cosmos. Another word I'd like to make about this, anima and anima. There are two kinds of experience that are involved in anima and animus experience, the experience of falling in love. And first of all, let me say, the standard Jungian view, as you probably all know, is we run into someone. And in falling in love, we project our anima or animus onto him or her. And now it's almost as though we have become gods. We are relating as gods to one another. But there's something missing here. If we're focused only on the projection, it's possible that we're going to miss the person behind that projection. It's possible that human relationship will be lost altogether. Maybe that's what happened to that young man. Maybe he got so caught up with the anima image he projected on her, he thought everything was going to be just all right. There was a woman of about 30 that saw me for a couple of years in the 1980s. And when she came in, she said her problem was phobias. We had to do something about her phobias. But one thing in her life was going well. She had a boyfriend, and she knew this was it. This is the one that God had chosen for her. And the moment they met one another, they fell into that state of knowing, yep, this is it. And so God was going to take care of that. We didn't have to worry about that. What we had to worry about was the fact that she was afraid of elevators and airplanes and other things that sort of took her away from the real world. You might say, see there's a little connection there. I don't know. But she didn't see it. A few months after she began, it turned out her boyfriend simply left her. He said he was going off to San Francisco, hoping to find a job, and when he found one, he'd send for her. And of course, the months went by, years went by, and he never sent for her, so the handwriting was on the wall. At that point, she began to confess to me that all had not been going so well with that boyfriend before he left. And she said, but she believed in the feeling she had when she met him, and she was never going to trust her feelings ever again. And I said, well, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with your feelings here. It's what you interpreted about those feelings that's the problem. You can't hope that somehow God is going to take away all the arguments that you have with your boyfriend. There's something that needs to be worked out in the arguments with the boyfriend. He's got to be right about some things while you're right about other things. There's got to be other ways of dealing with this. Anyway, so those are the kind of problems that come up when we project onto the other person and we're entirely taken up with the projection and think that's the reality, and the other person says, you don't know who I am. I'm heading for San Francisco. So withdrawing the projection would mean to know that that was me. That was part of my unconscious that was producing. And so there's a potential if the projection can be withdrawn. And by the way, this is one of the most difficult things to do in Jungian psychology, I would say. That would be what Jung would be pointing to when he says, that girl has introduced you to your anima. Your job now is to withdraw the projection. Now, I say, and this, I thought I was being original with this, by the way, when I wrote this in Divine Madness. This is what I would call a projection of the anima in the form, or animus, in the form of a mask that hides the beloved. And there's something about the rigidity of a mask. You have to be this image that I have of you, or else there's something wrong with you. That's the part that's wrong. But it seemed to me there was another way. And I call it using the anima or animus as a lens rather than as a mask. You know, you put the mask on the other, and you see the mask, and it's wonderful, but you never see the person behind it. When anima or animus is used as a lens, it brings the other's essential reality into view. It brings it into focus. It helps us see something that we were never able to see before. So it seemed to me, I mean, I brought this up on my own. I mean, in the sense of that I was trying to describe my experience. You don't write a book like Divine Madness if you haven't had a few experiences along those lines. And I had, and I didn't like that idea of the mask. I thought, you know, that makes some sense. But here's some problems with it. It's sometimes possible to meet the other person and really feel, and even get plenty of feedback, that you're seeing the essential being in that other person. That's going to happen too. And as though you've never seen into anybody like the way you're seeing into this particular person, that would be an anima or animus experience. And a more genuine one, I would think. And besides that, if you withdraw the projection, Where's anima and animus in the relationship? You know, don't you want them to stay there? Doesn't Jung say that there ought to be four parties in a real relationship? The two egos and the anima and the animus? He does say that. I mean, that's an archetypal relationship, and that's the way it should be. So we don't want to lose the anima and the animus. We don't want to pull them back in as though they were never projected. And so I thought this was a new addition. I was making an addition to Jungian psychology until I read again the last chapter of Volume 7 of the Collected Works. Two Essays in Analytical Psychology is the name of the volume, and the last chapter is called The Mana Personality. And in that first two paragraphs of the chapter, he says, well, the anima can be a complex. She who must be obeyed. The Kundri of the Grail legend. A powerful, primitive woman who is so far beyond my capability that I simply fall into her power. And you know, with Kundry, it was the king, the Grail king, Amfortas, who suffered from a ever-bleeding wound for 400 years until someone, Parsifal, could come along and heal him. So that's the danger that comes of the complex. But Jung says, as when you can integrate that complex, it takes up its appropriate role as an inner function of an intuitive nature. And that's like the situation where the primitive goes into the forest to speak. He says, I've gone into this forest to speak to my spirit. A little bird told me. I spoke to a snake. And all of these kinds of things, he's saying, we've known this. By bringing in what he calls primitive experience, he's saying, we've known this as long as we've been human beings, that there are other ways of knowing things that are right before you. It's not only the sensory functions of seeing and hearing and all the rest. There are intuitive functions. There are ways of knowing what's beneath the surface. So I thought, Jung actually had that lens doctrine. That idea of having an intuitive sense. I just hadn't ever noticed it as such before. I wanted to bring in another example from the Hindu world. I seem to be on a Hindu kick tonight. This is the story of the Mad Woman of Calcutta, which is told by the Ba'ul authority. The Ba'uls are a group of people who have mixed a sort of Islam, a Sufi Islam, and Hinduism together in their practice. The Ba'ul authority, Sri Anirvan, to the religion scholar June McDaniel, whose book is entitled "The Madness of the Saints: Ecstatic Religion in Bengal." Written in 1989, it's a fascinating book. So the story is about the mad woman of Calcutta, or Calcutta as they now say. About 20 years ago, in a residential section of the city, people used to see a very young and beautiful woman stopping passersby on the sidewalk in front of her house and asking them, "Where is my Shama Babu? Have you seen him? If you tell me where he is, I will go and fetch him." Her beloved was dead, and she was still waiting for him, living from her love for him. And love had betrayed her. The passers-by played cruel tricks on her. So this is Muktananda's young man all over again. A little bit of a difference. She's a little bit madder than he is because she is living in denial of the death of her beloved and hoping to be told where he can be found. Stories of Rumi imply the same thing, that Shamsuddin, his great master, was killed by Rumi's disciples because they didn't want to lose the Rumi they'd already always known, the one that hadn't had that mystical awakening. So he wrote much of his poetry was about his longing for Shams and the fact that he'd found the thing that Shams was about in this realizing that one of the metaphors he says is that he doesn't breathe air any longer now as a truly mystically mad individual. He breathes water like the fish. So, but let's get back to the mad woman of Calcutta. So that was stage one. Stage two, then another phase began for her. She clung to young men as they were going by and said to them, "You are my Shama Babu. You have come back." Since she was not a prostitute, these men drove her away and ill-treated her, even threw stones at her. Well, now she has gone another stage. Now she's finding him not unlike the Rumi who talked about the one who came in a red cloak last year and a brown garb this year, the Turk and the Arab and so on. They're all interchangeable because they all bring the wine of immortality with them. The bottles are different, but the wine is always the same. It seems as though she's getting to a point a little bit like that when every young man who comes by contains the wine that she's looking for. And finally, in stage three, after several more years, one of her neighbors who had known her in the past noticed her sitting all day long at the foot of the sacred tree of that district. She had aged, but her face was radiant with joy. She recognized her neighbor. He asked her, "Have you found your Shama?" "Yes," she replied with a lovely smile. "Look, there he is." And she pointed to her breast. Finally, she has withdrawn the projection, I guess Jung would say. And June McDaniel does not mention Jung at all, but what she does is she gives us the psychological / theological interpretation of this story that the Bengalis have. A true love and a longing for God will blow away the ego, leaving symptoms of madness behind. The future saint needs a much larger psychic container to hold those holy emotions. When one remains faithful to one's longing year in and year out, love itself will build the self structure that is needed. That's my insertion, self structure, in order to, so you can see the close, very close parallel for Jung. So if we look at this as a Jungian argument, when Jung says withdraw the projection, it's very difficult for us to know what it would mean to withdraw the projection. You know, as a person who has had to withdraw such projections, I can tell you that it takes a long time and it's pretty painful. And it means hanging in there with everything that comes up. When the young man says, "She keeps intruding into my thoughts day and night. I can't stop thinking about her." You got to let that happen. And you got to pay attention to the nature of those thoughts and those feelings that come up. And one of the things you'll be sure and see, you're going to see evidence of your own shadow. And one reason why that person walked away and married somebody else. You're going to see all that stuff if you hang in there with it for months and years. And I think something like that, at a pretty unconscious level probably, is what explains the story of the Mad Woman of Calcutta. But I wanted to say a couple of other things. You know, in order for a relationship of romantic love to exist, you need two things. For the most part, up till now, we have been talking about what in the medieval stories they call the love potion. When, you know, two people don't make the potion themselves and drink it in order to fall in love, someone else has always made it, and they drink it by mistake or by some contrivance that some enemy has brought to them or something like that. So it's always something that happens to them, and then once it has happened, they are transformed. They're no longer the individual persons they were before. They're somehow alchemically united. There's something, they are two pieces that belong together and can't ever be apart. And obviously this because these medieval stories are being told in a Christian environment, creates a little problem. I mean, usually the woman is married to the king or something like that. And very frequently the lover is the king's best knight. You know, thinking of Lancelot and Guinevere, thinking about Tristan and Isolde, all of those things. And those people did, in fact, travel about together from time to time. And they ran into monks and holy women and hermits and so on. And when they did meet them, the holy person always said, well, you guys shouldn't be together. Look, she's married and so forth. And when they said, oh, yes, but, you know, we drank the love potion. Oh, you drank the love potion. It seems like this was the great exception, you know. This wasn't deliberately chosen. This wasn't an ego choice. This was something that happened at another level. And even God is known to forgive that. In fact, God is probably going to honor it because all of these holy people spoke so highly of it. So that's we've been talking about that up to now. Really, and but there's another side to it, which I called in Divine Madness the naked sword. And the idea is something like this, that when the two lovers find themselves alone at night and sleep together, they put a naked sword between them. So they're voluntarily maintaining the separation. And my argument is, and I think this is impossible to refute, you need to have both the potion that brings you together and the sword that keeps you separate, because without the sword there's a sort of melding into one another, a losing of identity. The identities of the two people have to be their identities. They're going to be transformed identities transformed by what's happening to them, but they can't give up their own standpoint. They can't simply give in to the other. They can't simply persuade the other to be what they want them to be, as my Anna Lizanne did to her boyfriend. That, apparently that's what she was trying to do with her boyfriend who moved to San Francisco. So the lovers voluntarily place a naked sword between them when forced to spend the night together. Of course, they're not entirely forced. I mean, they're after all, they are wandering about together. So, and then night does come, and one does have to sleep, and so forth. Another item that I wanted to... So that I would say, that's something that every... episode of romantic love has to involve both the love potion and the sword. And people always ask about the demon lover, so I'll say a few words about that. It seems to me that what happens in the demon lover is that they can't hold the two things together. They can't hold the potion and the sword together. That would be what Jung would call holding the tension. You always have to hold the tension in these relationships where you're pulled one way and then the other. Not only in human relationships, in any aspect of your life. When you're pulled in two directions, you have to hold the two sides to give the what Jung calls the transcendent function an opportunity to manifest itself, to give us a third solution. I don't actually know where this picture is from, and the picture is the woman, and the picture on the left is actually a snake from her waist down. So she would represent some sort of a demon lover insofar as she's not fully human. There's something deeply instinctual and even cold-blooded in her being with that snake tail. And of course we know the story of Heathcliff, who was hardly socialized, but the great love of Catherine and Wuthering Heights. I'd like to just take one other example to talk for a moment or two about the demon lover. And this is an example that I did not use in the book. It comes from the Bluebeard story, and in particular, the Grimm brothers' version of the Bluebeard story, which is called Fischer's Bird. So here's this kind of suggestive picture of what goes on in the Bluebeard story. I'm sure you know it. The story is that there was a very wealthy and powerful man who had an unfortunate flaw, namely his blue beard. He was reputed to have married more than one woman, but no one ever saw his wife. So there was a great deal of suspicion around him. And in the Fitcher's Bird story, there are three daughters involved. You know, they usually are in fairy tales. And Fitcher, the Bluebeard character, approaches each one in turn. First, the eldest, and she agrees to marry him. And he takes her off to his castle in the woods, and he gives her a key. In fact, he gives her a whole ring of keys. He said he's a businessman, actually, and he's going off on a business trip, and he wants to tell her she's in charge of the castle now, and you can open any door with any of these keys, except don't open the smallest door with the smallest key. So naturally, as soon as he's gone, they run down to the smallest door, open it with the smallest key, and what they find there are all the dead bodies of his previous wives whom he's chopped up. I forgot to mention one thing. They not only had the ring of keys, he also gave each wife an egg to hold. And of course, each time a wife discovered what had happened to the previous wives, she was shocked and dropped the egg, and she didn't have an egg to show Fitcher when he returned from his business trip, and he thereby knew that she had she had learned his secret, and so she was chopped up and left in the room with the smallest door. And naturally, you can think that the youngest daughter of those three daughters is going to do something different, as always happens in fairy tales, and she does. She hides her egg away. She's already suspicious. And you have to think, why wouldn't she be suspicious? Two sisters have disappeared here. Anyway, so she goes in, she opens up the door, and she doesn't drop the egg because in her shock, she hasn't lost it. And this has something to do with being able to hold on to the emotion, to be able to go into overwhelming emotion and not simply be carried away with it. She evidently married the Bluebeard character with more self-awareness than the other two had had, probably because they had died first. We weren't told that. But she also had the presence of mind to ferret out the secret of the Bluebeard character. And so when he returns from his trip, she can hand him the egg and ask him if he had a nice trip. She now knows his secret, and he doesn't know that she does. He doesn't know her secret. So, this would be evidently a picture of the third sister who knows the dangers she's getting into as she's holding the key in her hand here. What she does now, but I left out one piece. When she found all those dead women, she also found the pieces of her sister's bodies and put them back together, and they came back to life. And so when Fitcher comes back from his trip, she puts the two sisters in a bag with a bunch of his gold on top of it and says she wants him to carry the bag with the gold back to her, doesn't tell her the sisters are in there, of course, back to her widowed mother's house and invite her widowed mother and all the villagers to his wedding. To the wedding between the two of them. And of course, she instructs the sisters to, when you get there, let the brothers and cousins know so that they can come and take care of this Bluebeard guy. And that's exactly what happens. Meanwhile, she stays at the castle, gets it ready for the wedding, invites all of Bluebeard's friends to the wedding, and I forgot to tell you, when he's carrying the bag, she says, "Don't set it down, because I'll be watching from my little window in the tower of your castle." And every time he sets the bag down, one of the sisters in the bag says, "I am watching from my little window," and he picks it up again and carries it on. So she's tricked him out of that. But after she gets the whole castle fixed up, she also takes one of those skulls down there in the smallest room and puts it up in that window where she's supposed to be watching from, and decorates it with flowers and jewelry so that it looks like she's looking out. And then she takes off all her clothes and jumps into a vat of honey and splits open a feather bed and rolls in the feathers. And she's walking out away from the castle covered in feathers as Bluebeard and his friends are approaching. And they refer to her as Fitcher's bird. So she gets out just in time. The brothers and the cousins, you know, demolish Bluebeard. The story is extremely unsatisfying. It has an almost psychotic quality. When I first read that story, I found it almost unbelievable that the Brothers Grimm would have collected it. Although, you know, other versions of Bluebeard do exist, and they are in the fairy tale collections. So this is about the most vivid case of demon lovers that we could find. When what has gone wrong? She's obsessed with the fact that she has no father. She has a widow for a mother. She wants an embrace to solve all her emotional problems, all the neglect that she suffered all her life. He wants to continue his ruthless ways. She's afraid to assert herself. He's terrified of being discovered. We got two people here who cannot open up. There's no intimacy. There's no sharing. There's no way to reveal one's own woundedness there. Each is clinging on to an ego possession, the possession of one's own ego and so forth. And now finally, I want to take this common theme from Hinduism and interpret that along the lines of the demon lover. Because here we have at the bottom there, that's Shiva in his form of Shava. That's the corpse of Shiva. And on top of him is Shakti, sometimes called Kali or Parvati or a bunch of other names. But in each case, it's always a bloodthirsty, maddened goddess. And by the way, those bloodthirsty, maddened goddesses are called mother by Hindus. They are beloved mothers. And you might wonder how. And what they will say is, she cuts off your head. She takes away your ego. She introduces you to the cosmic realm that we've been talking about since the beginning. And so this is what I see going on in these things. These are terrifying scenes. Gopi Krishna, who is famous for having experienced without knowing anything about it, having experienced a kundalini. Kundalini supposedly rose up the wrong tube in his subtle body and caused him tremendous difficulty. And he says in his account of this whole experience, he would find this picture again and again. And he said, "That's me. Everybody knows the torment I'm in." So he... That was his Corinthian column, obviously. He is finding his own pain depicted in this very common version of a Hindu experience. I might add that Shiva and Shakti are also seen as, or any god and god. The Shakti is the name for power. And every god has his Shakti, his female partner, who embodies his power. And one of the ways that is made sense of is to say the god, the spiritual principle, is unmoving, whereas the female is always moving. She represents nature. She represents the profusion of evolution. She represents everything that changes into something else, whereas he stays there as the consciousness of the whole. It's a vision very much like the vision Jung saw in the alchemists, that they were working with a material that was as much spiritual as material. A substance that was as much spiritual as it was material. There was nothing in the world that wasn't also spiritual. Actually, our views of quantum mechanics are coming to this point of view, that that there's something that goes all the way down, and that is a kind of consciousness that goes all the way down. And so what we see in this is an unresolved balance of that. I have one more picture of, and this shows sort of, this obviously comes from the Egyptian realm. And what it shows is an aspect of the myth of Isis and Osiris. Osiris is the god who brought civilization to Egypt, taught them how to till the soil, how to grow things, gave them the rules for the social order, the marriage rules, all of those kinds of things. And his brother Set, and there, so he's the sun god who is the source of all civilization, whereas his evil brother Set is the unrelenting power of the sun in the desert, which is a killing sun. And in the story that's depicted here, Set has tricked Osiris and chopped his body into 7 pieces. And therefore his sister wife, they're all brothers and sisters in the story, his sister wife Isis goes about collecting the pieces of the body and putting them back together, not unlike the story of Bluebeard. She gets them all put together except for the phallus, which is swallowed by a fish in the Oxyrhynchus fish in the Nile. but she fashions a phallus so that she can give birth to Osiris' son, Horus, which is a bird, the hawk, flying out of the picture. So what I'm arguing here is the anima putting the pieces of the god back together. All along here, it's been the emphasis has been on the young man, that young man at the beginning who lost the girl and who married somebody else. And then what's he going to do with his anima has been the problem. Well, here you can say the shadow of Osiris has brought about his end, almost as though it were another story of a demon lover. Myth I would think of in comparison there would be the myth of Artemis, when the hunter Octaeon comes upon her bathing, she turns him into a stag, and his hounds chase him and tear him apart. So it's very much like all of these people are being cut into fragments. The wives, Osiris, they're all being cut up, and here is the anima bringing them all back together again. When you have withdrawn the anima back in, she does gather up the pieces, as it were, and helps the person bring life forward. I would say this picture also has the culmination of the individuation story here, because out of it comes the new being. Out of Isis and Osiris comes the new sun god Horus, as he flies out of the picture at the top left. Might also mention there's a theme that is related to alchemy in the it's supposed to be lions trying to swallow the sun, like the green lion in alchemy, which represents an incomplete consciousness, a consciousness that's too youthful, a consciousness that has to grow. And that's the problem in the demon lover situation. One's consciousness has not grown. One has not held things together. One is chopped into pieces every time. But once we get to that part, then we can get to the place where Muktananda is. And here is a painting that I understand was made in the 18th or 19th century, but it does look like it was made by an alchemist, where the adept looks through the edge of the sensory cosmos and sees behind it the workings that make it all come into being, not unlike Muktananda's vision of the threads and the cloth. So with that hopefully happy ending, I would like to conclude this discussion of divine madness. And we can... anybody who wants to bring up a topic, and I will try to do my best with it. Yes.
I guess I'd sort of like to make it sort of a question, but I think also an observation that the person who may inspire that spark of divine, that love, that divine madness, it's not gender specific.
Right. No, right. And I certainly tended to say something like this. I did say it in the book, that I think what I'm talking about here is something that is not gender-specific, even though, as a man, I have probably collected more stories about men and their anima issues than women and their animus issues. But these things are not only about heterosexual couples as well. Any place you find romantic love, you have the same issues coming in. No, absolutely. I meant to say that. And I think in the book I say something to the effect that I think this applies to all people, no matter who their lovers are, what gender they are. But since I'm a heterosexual male, there is going to be a tendency for me to identify with the male protagonist and think of the woman as manifesting my anima. But yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you asked that question. Okay, Tom.
Well, I was just going to follow up a little bit, and I'm kind of confused about this. I really don't have a real clear because we're talking about anima and animus and male and female and masculine and feminine so much here, and it always gets kind of confusing and mixed up, and we slop all over the place with it. But is there like an element? I mean, there is this romantic infatuation, and it doesn't need to be gender specific. But is there a gender specific aspect to the dynamic between the anima and the animus and the male and the female? Maybe it's beyond, say, romance and beyond sex.
Mm. Yes, you pointed at a very confusing area. I believe that Jung's view is, but he doesn't say enough about animus to build a good case, it seems to me. I think he was too male-oriented in his approach anyway. And I think that Jungians in general make a mistake when they put too much emphasis on the gender qualities of anima and animus, because I've often said we need a term like anime, you know, that doesn't have either a female ending or a male ending, but because whether it's the anima or the animus, the function in the psyche of anima and animus is to mediate between ego and self. The ego has to have some notion of what's going on in our wholeness, which is the self, and the face of the self is usually will be of the gender that you are attracted to in these romantic love relationships. On the other hand, I think there's some truth in Jung's making gender distinctions. What he says is seems to me anyway, too specific. And I always remind people that Jung was born in 1875, and in the most conservative country in Europe, where women started to get the vote in the 1960s. So you know, already, and you know, that Emma Jung couldn't go to the university because she was a woman. Even though Sabina Spielrein, because she wasn't a Swiss woman, was able to go to the university. There's a lot in Jung's background that would make him conservative on this thing. And yet, you know, some of the descriptions that he makes of the kinds of arguments between men and women also seem to carry some truth value. Can't be true across all cases, but it does seem to be the case that women are more eros oriented, relationship oriented, feeling oriented. Men tend to stay away from that. The most common complaint I hear from women about their men is that they don't know what their feelings are and won't talk about them. You know, so there's there is a tendency whereby these distinctions that Jung makes have a general applicability, but I would say you'll find exceptions everywhere. I don't know if that answers the question sufficiently, but
yes,
it's got three or four dimensions to it. Yeah. Yes, now you.
Yeah, I was just curious about my mind was kind of going in a slightly different but connected direction, and I was wondering about, you know, whether it's a male or female gender-wise, you know, and then you know, the particular. I was just wondering about the correlation between people's bonding or lack thereof bonding with the opposite parent and the weight of the projection in romantic love. Do you follow me?
I guess you're saying that our parental relationships are going to have a bearing on our love choices later on. And I think that's absolutely true. I hate to make generalities about it, but I think it can't not be true. In fact, it seems to me that we often fall in love with someone who's like one of our parents. It doesn't have to be the opposite, you know. It isn't necessarily the case that a man falls in love with someone who's like his mother. He might fall in love with someone who psychologically is like his father, even though she's a woman. But I think what happens is, in especially our first loves, our earliest loves, we're finding somebody who's like one of our parents, who we seem to understand very, very well. And we don't know that we understand them so well because we're familiar with this pattern that we had in our parent. And we're hoping finally to break through with whatever the issues were with that parent, with that lover. And that generally what happens is, at least in the beginning, is we run into the same problems and fail to solve them in the same ways. But I do think this is about as far as I feel like I am comfortable going talking about the relationship between the parent and the lover.
If individuation is part of that, is to come into some kind of balance between our masculine and our feminine qualities that are within each of us. And I know we throw those terms around a lot, but what you just said about them, the different qualities of those two. I'm wondering, in your experience, in your practice, if you've seen, as time's gone on these last decades since the women's movement, if you feel like more women are feeling they need to reside in more masculine ways of being or not. And how that affects love relationships.
Well, I wouldn't put individuation as about the balancing the feminine and masculine sides. Individuation is about the ego finding a creative relationship to the wholeness of the self. In fact, I put it this way. What's different between us and an animal, especially a lower animal? It's harder to tell. I'm not so sure I want to say dogs, for example, don't have egos. But there is something different between us and a lower animal than that, whereby we have an ego which can go off in directions that ignores what's needed by our wholeness. That, it seems to me, is the inherent tension that characterizes every human life. So every human life has a tension between our organism, which is also spiritual, not only biological, but it's also biological. Our organism trying to find exactly the right thing to do now for its wholeness in this moment. So that's going on. Meanwhile, the ego has all sorts of ideas about what it wants to do about living its life, and it may be throwing everything out of balance. So the tension between the ego's sort of thoughtful, self-reflective processes and the self's organismic wholeness thing, that tension is individuation, and every human being is in that tension, whether he or she knows it or not. And Jung asks us to take up that tension. That is the psychological practice of analytical psychology, to take up the tension between ego and self and try to find a way to for ego to choose its way through life while at the same time maintaining and building our harmonious relationship with self. Now, no doubt, masculine and feminine traits will be involved in that, but I think the heart of individuation is there.
So what a person, a woman, her ego might be it directed in a very masculine way, mm-hmm. and self may be calling for something else.
That surely could be, and the opposite could be true, too. Yes, and I forgot the part of the question that I didn't answer, of course, whether I have seen changes and... I'm reluctant to categorize changes in too clearly, but there's no doubt that we are strongly influenced by what our culture expects of us at any time, and Jung says there are, if you read two essays in analytical psychology clearly. Carefully, you'll see that this is the clearest statement Jung ever makes, that individuation has two sides to it. One is the side that I just mentioned about the ego self problem, and the other is that the ego not only has to have a healthy, ongoing, always creative relationship with the self, but it also has to have a relationship to the public world. The public world is that thing that keeps changing all the time and having different expectations sometimes for women in one generation than it had in another. And so I think there's no question that those kinds of changes go on, and that people argue with themselves about their lives. Women, or we could say even, argue about themselves while they're going through their lives, because they're being influenced by and struggling with the expectations that they feel being put on them by society. Yeah.
Every culture probably has things it does well and things it does poorly about helping the ego along this path of finding the organic wholeness of the self.
Yeah.
When you look at North American culture or Boston where you practice, pick a place or a culture, national or local, and give some of the specifics about the good and the bad, about what the culture's doing to lead or mislead the ego.
Oh, you want that's what you want me to do now? Well, I think that's too big an undertaking. It takes somebody with somewhat of a different orientation than me, I think, too. I mean, that's almost a sociological question.
In your practice. Mm-hmm. What are some of the characteristic things? I assume your practice is around Boston.
Yes.
What are some of the characteristic things that you feel that local culture is doing to lead or mislead the ego in a healthy way or not healthy way?
Oh, man. There are so many ways. I think we are... Almost everything in our society is unhealthy, it seems to me, you know, and we need to start reflecting on, the biggest thing facing us, for example, is climate change. I mean, this is going to be huge if we don't do anything about it, and we're determined not to do anything about it. We're determined to keep our head in the sand, and we may even pay lip service to it. We may even buy a Prius. But, still, we've got to do stuff at every level. Things have got to be planet-wide organized. And we're not doing that, and I don't see when we're going to do that. I think that kind of denial runs throughout our society and throughout the world, even. We want short-term solutions. We want five-year plans. And we don't want them to have to make us change any. I think that's what I see, and I can't say that Boston's any different from Seattle or Hong Kong. I think it's pretty much everywhere we're in denial, and I'm not qualified to speak about how Boston's different, I don't think.
I have two questions, actually. I'll say the maybe one you can answer second first, which is could you say something about what tomorrow might entail, this what your plans are for tomorrow. But the first question has to do with the epidemic of internet pornography that's hitting us, and how you would conceptualize that from an analytical psychology point of view in terms of what's being projected onto the image, what's being received from the image, and in terms of the anima and animus.
I have a few thoughts on that. The first question was, what are we going to do tomorrow? And whoever I was talking to when I was invited to do this sort of laid out a few thoughts, which I went along with, and this is how I put it together. Now, that there are two other related books that I wrote related to Divine Madness. So I thought we would take the morning. I think we have 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours after lunch, if that's what I understand anyway. And that we'd take the morning and we'd talk about how this all has an impact on analysis. What does it mean for analysis if Divine Madness is telling us something important? And what I'm hoping to do in the morning is just to sit down and talk. And have those of you who are therapists and analysts and or analysands or simply have opinions to just jump in and talk, and we'll see where that goes. In the afternoon, I had something slightly more structured in mind, if the technology will be present for it, and that is to talk about. It's based on Jung's seminar on Kundalini Yoga. And I would like to offer some of my observations on how the Jung presents the seven chakras of the Kundalini Yoga as an individuation process. It's actually very strongly based in Jung's monomyth of the night sea journey of the sun. And so what I'd like to do is talk about where a person is when a person is living predominantly in one chakra or the other. And we can talk about that in terms of what it means for analysis or what it means for what one should do with one's life, that kind of thing. So anyway, I would take the slides and show, you know, keep going, coming back to the picture of the yogi sitting in a lotus position and locating the chakra and then seeing some of the things that Jung says about it, some images from various places. So that was the idea there. Now, the question that I've avoided... What was it again?
You could just riff on pornography.
Oh, yeah, all right.
And the image, the power of the image. And, mm-hmm. Just your thoughts on that.
Well, I think it's a great escape, and it's a false solution. I haven't heard women talking about using pornography. It seems to be much more of a male issue. And... for example, one man, a very accomplished man, extremely successful in the professional world, came in and told me that he was afraid of his wife, and they've never had sex. They tried a little bit in the beginning of their marriage, but it never worked out. So he doesn't even press for that anymore, but he told me that he was using pornography all the time. And I'm going to stick with one person because, I mean, I could talk about other people who have somewhat similar stories. But anyway, I told him that it was keeping him stuck where he was, that the sexual drive he had, which was getting released by looking at pornography, getting an erection, masturbating, and dispensing with the drive, that energy should be taken into the marriage in order to solve some of the problems that were there. It took a while. He admitted to me that he had a locker, you know, one of those... places that you could get at U-Haul or one of these places where you can put away your stuff. He had a locker full of pornography. And I would say within the first 6 months, He got rid of all of the stuff in the locker, but he kept a few. And eventually he convinced himself that he should not masturbate. A year or so later, he went to a Chinese herbalist. And the herbalist took his check, his pulses or whatever, and said, "Geez, you're not getting any sex, are you?" He told how he was trying to avoid masturbation and so on. And the guy said, "Well, it's just over. It's just too much. You know, you're not supposed not to do it at all. You know." So he decided that gave him permission. And the next time he went back, the herbalist said, "Whoa, you've really turned everything around here now, haven't you?" So, I mean, it seems to me these are the kinds of things that happen, is that people swing from one extreme to the other, and it's hard to solve the problem because the pornography is always there. Even without a cache of pornography in a U-Haul room, you can turn on your computer at any time. So, right. So I think that's what's happening, is a tremendous amount of interest and so on is going there, and the person is not solving the problems in life. And I have heard other people who are dissatisfied with their jobs, don't know where they're going to go next, whether even to look for to have a more satisfying job. But instead of doing that, they're spending a lot of time doing pornography. So, I mean, it almost every time it comes up, it's a way. It's an easy way to avoid doing something substantial in your life.
So you're just saying it's more of an escape than there's some kind of a way that it's a projective object of some sort. You know, where like within the love relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there's no love relationship at all. Yeah, I mean, those are images for him, not real people. He doesn't ever have to have a real relationship. All he does is look at the curbs or whatever to find it interesting enough to get an erection. And so, but, you know, on the other side of it is this disrespectful of women? Yes, of course it is. There's no question about that. And so a person who's doing that really is running women down. They're not people. He's not thinking about them as people to be related to. He's thinking them about as objects to get aroused over.
How do you withdraw a projection? Is it hard?
Yes, it's very hard. I think the only thing you can do to withdraw a projection is to pay attention. And what you have to pay attention to is usually unpleasant. You know, it's there's a reason for the projection. Excuse me. And it's, on the one hand, your psyche is trying to show you a way forward to some transformation in your life, which probably you're resisting in some way or other. So when you hang in there with the feelings that come with withdrawing the projection, which means withdrawing the projection for me means holding on to all of the feelings and memories and everything that comes up in connection with whatever it is that we're dealing with. You know, in this case, we've been talking about withdrawing the projection of an anima or an animus on another person. Well, to do that, of course, if you can really do that, you begin to see, I have the capacity for this sort of cosmic consciousness myself. And I think I need her, or she thinks she needs him, because only when we're together do we feel that cosmic connection. And the fact of the matter is, it can be felt the way Rumi learned to feel it, where it didn't make any difference who his scribe was. His scribe could be, for him that day, the sheikh into which he was annihilated. So, I mean, that's, and so that, there are things holding us back, and we're going to start encountering those things that are holding us back when we hang in there with it and pay attention to the feelings and the images, the memories.
So yes. Why is it that men don't know what they feel?
I don't know. Jung's theory, when he puts it the way he puts it, seems to imply they don't come by it naturally. I don't know whether he implies that it's in our DNA not to pay attention to that. I don't know, but here's a thought, which is just a thought. There are several passages in Faulkner's novels where he talks about the difference between men and women. And it usually takes the form of men flying off into space and women moving along the curve of the earth. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. It has to do with the fact that everything about a woman is concerned about what's going on here. We got kids to raise. Where is the food? Where are the guidelines? You know, where is the money going to come from to send the kids to college? All that kind of stuff women are deeply immersed in. They're the ones that have the babies, nurse the babies, feed and take care of the babies. They're going to be anchored on Earth, whereas men without an anchor like that can sail off into space. And I think there's a lot of truth in that that thing, that men don't stay put, don't look at what's going on right now.
Yes. Yeah, I agree with you. That's true. But I'd also like to say that there's the home and the fire and the loving mother and the children. And it takes a lot to leave that and to go out and find something. Kill it. Bring it back. And there's a big price that we pay for that. And maybe part of that price is feeling and leaving the home too.
You don't consciously educate the feelings.
Yeah.
Just catch and catch can. It isn't really in the curriculum of the school directly.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're lucky, you have people who are sensitive who talk these things through with you. And if you're not, then you just follow models that are around and not be very good models.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's true. A friend of mine with a very Jungian interest, but never hung in to become an analyst or anything like that, used to say that he thought that men, because they haven't developed a consciousness of those things that you just mentioned, are always getting their feelings hurt in relationships. Whereas women, for women, it's like they're having their dignity undermined or something like that. It's a slightly different shade, and it has to do with the fact that the men haven't developed a consciousness of their feelings. And they haven't differentiated the feelings, I think, the way women tend to do. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I was going to ask, I'm in my 60s, and I'm going through a divorce, and what's the point of having a relationship for older people who are past the age of raising a family? There's not really any real purpose. And I suspect that my feelings of wanting to be with a partner may actually just be residual memories and emotions from early in life. So I don't think there's any reason to. I mean, that doesn't really help me get rid of my feelings, but my longings. But I don't think there's really a point to it. You know what I'm saying?
Hmm. Well, I'm 72, and I think that the marriage that I'm in is the most important thing in my life. The companionship, the understanding, the support, how imagination is developed on both sides, that stuff is, for me, it's indispensable. And I would say that, probably, having written a book like Divine Madness. So, and I, what I'm saying is, what the thing was about when you didn't have any kids is still about that after it's too late to have any. That's what I'm thinking.
Mm-hmm. So, if I can, I'm going to dovetail a little bit off of what this gal was asking, perhaps. So, when you were speaking about how, when I asked about why can't men fail, and you described men going out into space and women being in the curve of the earth, my concern about whatever Faulkner might have written and has influenced so many is that, isn't it possible that the ancient thinking was that the spiritual and the above was superior in some way, and the earthy, that here below, is inferior. And so therefore, those of us that are trying to come of our own as women appear to be somehow masculine because we're freer now to use our thinking to get ahead, but we're not masculine in our feelings. So we have to remember, I guess what I'm asking in some way is it possible that some of that ancient influence needs to be looked at again in terms of what is the superior and the inferior and all that kind of thing? Do you know what I'm referring to?
I think I do. Yeah, I think I do. I think you're referring to something that seems at least quite archetypal. We could talk about hunter-gatherers, which is probably what you were referring to there, where and what Tom over here was referring to about having to go out and find the game. What I understand about hunter-gatherers are is that almost everywhere you find them, there's more being gathered than is being hunted. That is to say, the hunts bring something back, something special, but the gathering is what pulls you through day in and day out. And it also, my impression is, and I can't say that I'm an expert on this, but it seems to me that the agricultural revolution changed the relationship dramatically, where it was important for the woman to bear as many children as possible so they could help on the farm. And so women became demoted, you might say. The men were the ones who owned the farm. The men sent the boys and girls as much as they could out into the farm to work it. There was a tremendous loss for women in the transition that took place somewhere around 10,000 years ago, when we hunting and gathering gave way to agriculture as a way of, and that's been with us all ever since. I mean, look at the Old Testament, and you see a God, an agricultural God, and so we've been passing this along for quite a few millennia now. And I wouldn't rule out the possibility that in some future millennia, if we have one, you know, if we get from increasing global warming that we're doing now to something else, we're going to have to come up with some sort of a Gaia concept where we're all taking care of planet Earth. There's almost an inherent goddess notion in that, it seems like. It seems so. Possibly, we need to switch back to a. Well, I think it's not possible. I think it's certain that we need a new myth, and the new myth has to be less about conquering and more about supporting. That is less of what men think they've been doing, and more of what women think they've been doing.
Thank you.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is
C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.